Hi, everyone. Welcome to Topical Fever, episode 7. My name is David Parsons, and I am very happy if you're listening to this podcast. If you're enjoying what you're listening to, please don't hesitate to let me know via, the various social media that we've got these days, Facebook, Twitter, etc. This week, I brought in a very special guest, very special for a few reasons. One is that she's my wife, Claudia Moreno Pisano. She's also someone who knows a lot about the subject that I wanted to talk about this week, and that's the prevalence of apocalyptic fiction in our world, and particularly in American culture. My initial thought was, you know, if you had a friend, if you knew someone who was always talking about death and always kind of fantasizing about death and obsessing about their own death and the death of others, then you might think that that person has maybe not something wrong with them, but definitely something worth exploring in the deeper recesses of their psyche, right? You might think this person has something going on, right? Whatever it might be, there's something going on. The obsession with death is really an expression of something, you know, much larger, maybe, you know, anxiety and fear and paranoia and all those kinds of things. So that's kind of how I feel about American culture's current kind of obsession with apocalyptic fiction. And when I say that, I mean in the last maybe 15 to 20 years, particularly in cinema, but also in literature, there's been kind of a boom of apocalyptic end of the world type scenarios. Certainly, you know, Justin and I on this show have talked a little bit about the end of the world in terms of actual political and economic scenarios. But on this show, I kind of wanted to think about why we fantasize about these scenarios on the screen and in literature and think about these things all the time, and how, in the same way that you might think your friend that obsesses about death needs to figure out what's really going on, maybe we as a culture need to explore why it is that we keep producing this fantasy about the entire system collapsing, about everybody on Earth dying, about New York City and other places being set on fire or flooded or invaded by aliens, etc. And so Claudia came in to talk about this with me, partially because she often functions as the voice of reason to me when I get off the rails in my kind of apocalyptic thinking. Claudia is someone who I think in this conversation highlights how apocalyptic fiction is not necessarily unique to our time. You know, while we may be going through a period of deep transition and deep crises and perhaps even ends of systems that seem apocalyptic, Claudia reminds me that the apocalypse and apocalyptic fiction is more of a universal human impulse, right? It's something that throughout human history, people have conceived of and fantasized about the end of the society that they live in, and what that means. And so we talk about a lot of different things that I put up on the blog. I put kind of a wiki collection of all the different cultural pieces that we talked about on the show. On this episode, I wanted to point out a couple things. One thing that we missed, we tried to think of a piece of apocalyptic fiction that took it all the way, and by that I mean really showed the true end of the world where there's no survivors, and how that would even, I think I say something like in the conversation you're about to hear, I say something like that if there were such an end of the world kind of movie that took it all the way, the film would disintegrate and burn up or something like that. But there is a movie that I can remember now, and that movie is Lars von Trier's Melancholia that came out a couple years ago with Kirsten Dunst and Charlotte Gainsbourg and Kiefer Sutherland and a few other people. A really, really great movie that actually, you know, I don't want to give it away. I don't think I am giving it away. But the movie kind of takes it all the way with the end of the world scenario, and it's actually an incredible piece of, I think, apocalyptic fiction, and a particularly unique expression of that in the way that only Lars von Trier could do. Okay, so this was a good conversation. Another thing that I wanted to point out is I used the word chrysanthemum, which isn't even a word, at some point in the conversation too, and I think I meant to say chrysanthemum, but I can't imagine why I was referring to a flower as the symbol of the end of history, and maybe that'll make more sense in context when you hear that. But also, I wanted to say before I play this conversation with Claudia and I wanted to invite you to participate in the conversation a little bit through, again, Facebook or Twitter or whatever you've got to be in touch with me, especially if you have ideas for topics you'd like to hear me talk about or ideas for guests, or perhaps if you yourself would like to be a guest and suggest a topic for us to talk about. I'm open to all those suggestions. I would love to get more people involved in these kinds of conversations. So I hope you enjoy this one between Claudia and I on apocalyptic fiction. Okay, so, I mean, when you're talking about apocalypse, for me, it's you're talking about two separate things. You're talking about, one, a kind of actual thoughts about, you know, reality and the current political and economic system and that kind of collapse stuff that Justin and I have touched on other episodes of Topical Fever. But then you also have the apocalypse as a fantasy, which, yeah, you know, a kind of fictional thing. And when you talk about that, you begin to uncover this, you begin to recognize or acknowledge the fact that this vision has been with us for a very long time, right?
Yeah, it's the cultural, I don't know, cultural persistence of its own death. And the visions of its death are about its own present and its own reality. And it's really interesting to me to look at how cultures envision the end, because I think it says something about what they think about themselves.
Yeah,
currently.
Yeah, I think that's something that we need to unpack a little bit, because we're currently living in a time where fiction about apocalypse is very, very popular. Not just,
yeah,
not. I mean, actually, I would definitely describe these as apocalyptic times, in at least in terms of the overall kind of consciousness, right?
Yes.
Because you have, on the one hand, you have like the, you know, Alex Jones comes up on the show a lot, these kind of doomsday prepper kind of culture that's about like the coming, you know, collapse of whatever, the
right,
U.S. economy or whatever. But we also have a lot of fictional works about that exact thing, right?
Right.
Like, I mean, you and I have seen a few movies just recently that are about this, but I would say the last probably 15 years. I hate to be stuck in the 90s, but I'm thinking about like Armageddon and Deep Impact. Those came out just a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah.
No, not really.
Well.
95, 98, something like that. But either way, that vision is very popular right now, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, well, I would qualify and say I think that as the literature person, that visions of apocalypse have seem to have existed from very early on. We're constantly imagining the end of the world. I mean, if you go way, way back, you see that there's floods and there's locusts and there's all kinds of...
The Bible,
yeah,
is a particularly apocalyptic work of literature, right?
Right, right. But I think it's really interesting the kinds of apocalyptic visions that have happened in the last, let's say, 20 years, right? And some of that has to do with climate change. Much,
yeah,
of that has to do with climate change. And mm-hmm, that's what I was saying before, is that I think that...
Climate change and financial crisis and all the,
yes,
other kind of like terrorism. You know,
right.
We live in times that do like kind of lend themselves to a certain kind of fantasy.
That's
right?
And that's my point, is that the kind of fantasy that the culture is having has to do with its... what is happening to it. And that's why in the last 15 years, you get the day after tomorrow. Is that what it's
day
called?
After tomorrow. Day after tomorrow. That was about literally about climate change.
Right, yeah, right. That they're all about some kind of the collapses and the crises that we presently are facing or not facing or believe,
mm-hmm,
we're facing.
Yeah,
however,
right,
that sort of plays out. And that's what's really interesting. I really feel like you can do it's a sort of cultural fantasy of itself.
Yeah,
right?
So I think what... If I can paraphrase what I think you're saying, is that we're not actually living in uniquely apocalyptic times.
Mm-hmm.
We're just living through our own expression of apocalyptic times, because every culture kind of has a way of imagining their end.
Yes.
Right?
I don't mean that to be the end all be all sort of like, huh, that's the answer to it. But yes, like, that's yeah, my
we're not making a Joseph Campbell type story type point here.
Yeah, no, but that's how in sort of my, I don't know, just experience of it or readings of it, that's what it looks like to me. It looks like there's this human thing that we do because it's the death is the one thing that we don't fully, well, it's one of the many things we don't mm-hmm. understand, but mm-hmm. because we don't cross that line.
Certainly a big one though.
Yeah, exactly. And so it seems to be part of human nature to think about that and both on the individual level and then also on the cultural level.
And you know, The Walking Dead is an incredibly popular show right now. And it's one that's that, you know, is about zombies, and zombies are certainly popular right now. Yes. And have been for a while, but zombies are just kind of one expression. It seems like Walking Dead is, and I, you know, I have to, you know, say I haven't really seen the show that much, so I can't really talk that much about it, but it does seem like a show that kind of envisions more than just zombies. It's about the kind of overall experience of the end of American life.
Right.
And so, you know, I brought up the zombie thing because, you know, the other day when we were talking about recording this episode, I found a quote from Simon Pegg. Some of you may know who that is. He's a kind of British comedic actor. Seems like a really smart guy, actually. And even smarter after I read this article that he wrote about zombies. He's a writer of the movie Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, a couple of other really cool kind of smart.
Shaun of the Dead being one of the. Understood to be one of the best zombie movies,
right ever. and it's a very satirical, so I mean it's right. It's really very very like meta and self-conscious, and he's a smart guy. And so I read this quote from him and I wanted to read it because it's because I thought it kind of captures what how I think about the apocalypse and or apocalyptic fiction and what it means. And he's talking about he has the editorial that he wrote in The Guardian is about how he doesn't like the development of the fast zombie.
Right. A lot 28 days later.
28 days later is probably the biggest, most popular example of the fast zombie. And he hates it. And the reason Simon Pegg hates the fast zombie as a development in recent recent zombie fiction is because he thinks it betrays what the zombie actually represents and what it is as a psychological kind of icon or an archetype. And so this is his quote. He says, "The fast zombie is bereft of poetic subtlety. As monsters from the id, zombies win out over vampires and werewolves when it comes to the title of most potent metaphorical monster. Where their pointy-toothed cousins are all about sex and bestial savagery, the zombie trumps all by personifying our deepest fear, death. Zombies are our destiny writ large. Slow and steady in their approach, weak, clumsy, often absurd, the zombie relentlessly closes in, unstoppable, intractable. However, and herein lies the sublime artfulness of the slow zombie, their ineptitude actually makes them avoidable, at least for a while. If you're careful, if you keep your wits about you, you can stave them off, even outstrip them, much as we strive to outstrip death. Drink less, cut out red meat, exercise, practice safe sex. These are our shotguns, our cricket bats, our farmhouses, our shopping malls. However, none of these things fully insulates us from the creeping dread that something so witless, so elemental, may yet catch us unawares. The drunk driver, the cancer sleeping in the double helix, the legless ghoul dragging itself through the darkness towards our ankles." That's Simon Pegg in the Guardian. I'll put that link up on the blog. But I thought that was a really kind of poetic rendering of, yeah. of what zombies were. That they kind of represent this this kind of slow creeping death that you can't ever avoid.
Right. But you can do things to hold it off or hope that you hold it off. I love that idea.
Eventually, the zombie's
going to get you.
Hole up in a farmhouse or in the middle of the woods, and at some point, you know, you're going to run out of bullets.
Yeah.
And the teeming hordes are going to swallow you up.
Yeah.
No matter what you do. And it's such a kind of elegant metaphor for what death is, and turns it and makes it very biological in nature and psychological in nature. What I like about the quote though too from Simon Pegg, or at least that idea, is that it's not just about zombies. It's a you can when I read that, it was like, that's the apocalypse.
Yeah.
That's what we do when we envision the apocalypse, is we envision, well, we're not going to get away with this somehow, you know?
Right, right. And you know, the I think the epitome of the slow zombie that he's talking about there is George Romero's Night of the Living Dead from 1968, mm-hmm. which is that for my first memory and vision, I think probably many's, of that the slow creeping dread of the buildup, and it's the kind mm-hmm. of worst possible way to imagine death, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. it's so slow, you see it coming, and there's kind of nothing you can eventually do about it, right? And so right. the film's work in a way to kind of release that tension that people have, both mm-hmm. culturally and personally, about the end.
Yeah, and you know, that being our own like personal kind of apocalypse, right? Mm-hmm. That's really what we're thinking about when we think about the end is our own lives. And that's why, you know, obviously so many of these apocalyptic stories, you know, you kind of have to do this as a literary device, but you kind of see it through the eyes of a certain hero, right?
Like right.
a certain one guy usually.
Yeah. Right? It's often a guy, mm-hmm. right? And this is part of the 20th, well, not that's just the 20th century, part of American cultural legacy.
Right.
And I was thinking here in the Twilight Zone episode, Time Enough at Last, which is from the very first season, which is from 1959, mm-hmm. which is it's Burgess Meredith, and his character's name is Bemis, I think. Uh-huh. Henry Bemis.
Right.
And he's preparing for, the world is preparing for nuclear war. He knows it's coming, and he's filling up the vault with books, and he's just hoarding books. And I remember, you know, the plot of the story is that the nuclear apocalypse happens, and mm-hmm. he's left, and he's alone, and he's survived because he's in the vault with all his books, and then his glasses break.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
so he's dead too, essentially.
Very memorable, and he's yes. yeah, there's kind of like this triumphant moment where he's like, yes, I finally have the, everyone's, I mean, yeah. it's so morbid.
It's also
and
misanthropic it's, because he,
yeah,
he
because
can't,
because he's
he
like, thank God
wait.
I'm alone.
Yeah,
like, thank God everyone on earth is dead yeah. and I can read. So there's like, it's tragic in a couple different ways.
Yes, exactly.
It's tragic because this guy, you know, finally gets to be alone with his books and in his ideas and just be left by himself. But it took nuclear apocalypse for him to imagine that, or for for the, and in the Twilight Zone universe, I love how devilish that is, because it's like there's so many kind of multiple angles to that story.
There yeah,
like, Twilight Zone did that a lot. Twilight yeah. Zone, I feel like watching those when I was a kid, and I don't know how many of you out there watched Twilight Zone when you were a kid, but this is these things are serious traumatic kind of things, and when I think of the Twilight Zone, I think of them as creepy partially because of exactly what you're talking about, which is that this is reflecting the society,
yeah.
And this is like looking at late 50s early 60s American culture,
yes,
and understanding that,
especially growing the growing metropolis, mm. And I think that Stephen King does this in The Stand later plays on the same conflict that we as city people have,
yes.
that the presence of too many people around us and the growing population of the planet causes a certain amount of anxiety, but at the same time, and so we sort of, there's a sort of fantasy that it'll just be me and I can do what I wish. Stephen King's The Stand, which is I think it's like 80 something, I don't remember,
I think
offhand.
Like, yeah, late 80s,
yeah, something like that.
But you didn't read it then, right?
I read it
like maybe in the mid 90s.
I was probably a teenager. So yeah, the mid 90s, I would guess, early 90s, something like that. Not super long after it came out. I
yeah,
have to double
yeah,
check
yeah,
that date. But a really memorable thing about that kind of connects to the Twilight Zone here is that he does these great scenes where the protagonist is alone in New York at last, mm-hmm. and he has no need for money anymore, and he can just take the stuff that he wants, and he's looking with sort of fantasy eyes at the stores and all the stuff in it and the clothes and the food, and it's this kind of like, ah, oh, there's nobody there. But then there's also immediately upon that is like also the, oh my God, there's nobody here around. And this is really scary, and it's a real conflict, I think, that anxiety that we have about
yes.
what, how many people do we really want around us.
Yeah, right. And I think the New York thing is important because it's almost like the fantasy is, God, I live in this place, this great place with so many great things around, but there's a system that prevents me from enjoying all that stuff. And part of the system is just the, you know, people, but there's also like, money. And they did it on mm-hmm. Twilight Zone a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That like that the collapse of the apocalypse is actually the collapse of the capitalist system in some way.
Yeah, yeah, there's exactly.
There's another one, a Twilight Zone that I don't know if you saw, that's not necessarily, I wouldn't call it apocalyptic, but it speaks to the same kind of fantasy of being like alone on the earth. It was the guy that could, they had a watch, they pressed the watch and it stopped everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember this?
I remember this, yeah.
And what did he do? He went to, he ends up going to a bank at the end and he stops it and he's going to rob the bank. And he stops time and everybody freezes and he goes in, he gets all the money, and then as he's wheeling this cart full of cash out of the bank, he drops the watch and runs over it with the cart and it breaks. And he realizes that he has all the money in the world, but everybody's frozen. In other words, he can't bring people back to life. Everybody's frozen
forever. That
really
is terrifying.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so there's this kind of like double edge with Twilight, yes. with Twilight Zone of like the fantasy of being alone, but also the horror of that.
Yeah, and I think that's a double edge in much apocalyptic
vision
and fiction and film is that questioning of what we are as human beings. That's why I think that this,
like,
this,
are we social creatures really?
Right. Yeah. That's why it's so, I think that's why these movies and fiction and all that are so fascinating for people, mm-hmm. and why they always have an audience, because they cause you to question the nature of what we do at all. And mm-hmm. it's a really important kind of question.
It also seems like it could be a weird kind of expression of how unhappy people are. Like the fact that these things are popular, and the fact that we like to fantasize about the entire system collapsing and us just like running through a, you know, a Manhattan that's overgrown with trees and mm-hmm. stuff like that. I think I wasn't a huge fan of the Will Smith I Am Legend, but the film did a great job of envisioning what it would be like to walk around New York City alone.
I agree.
And there's something eerie about it.
Yes.
And there's something fantastic about it.
Yes.
That I'm even imagining right now, like what it would be like to, because on the few times that and we've talked about this before, that New York is a place that has millions of people in it, but you can still find yourself actually quite often on streets by yourself.
Yeah.
Like, even in the middle of the day. Like, you can mm-hmm. I can be walking on 22nd Street in Midtown Manhattan on a Tuesday afternoon.
On a residential block.
On a residential block. And there's
no one there.
And there's not a soul around. Yeah. And it feels really eerie because I'm not a native New Yorker, many of you know that. So when I was a kid, I envisioned that people would be everywhere.
Right, all the time.
So, yeah, but the idea of an empty New York street is one that it is ripe with a lot of imaginative possibilities, right?
Yeah,
it's kind of like it's a fantasy and a fear.
Yeah, absolutely. You said something before.
Oh no! See, this is what happens. I talk too much, and then we lose the point. We were talking about The Stand. If that helps you at all.
Oh, okay. You were talking about visions of maybe human beings being unhappy, right, or dissatisfaction,
and the popularity of apocalyptic fiction kind of being that expression.
And as a I don't know, a cultural studies, cultural historian mm-hmm. person,
right.
I think about that in terms of that maybe these tap into an inner critique that people have of the systems in which we are enmeshed,
right? Oh, totally.
That they are the thing of the taking all the stuff, right? Like the Twilight Zone with the bank robber, and The Stand with the taking stuff out of the stores, getting everything you need, and
that was a real fantasy.
And desire of like just being able to get all the stuff
want. just going to a car dealership and stealing the motorcycles,
right?
Going to the gun store and getting the shotguns. And I mean, it's not just The Stand that does that. I feel like The Stand.
No, of course not.
The Stand was an early template for all of us to fantasize about this end of the world thing.
Yeah.
But it's funny because you always think of, you know, I started off today talking about like the real, actual end of the world, and that's certainly something that's worth talking about too. But the point is that we always imagine, and probably it's because of all this fiction, we always imagine that we're going to live through it. Right.
Right. That's
like,
the whole
like,
point.
Like, oh, a nuclear bomb will hit New York City. We live in New York, but somehow we'll survive and find ourselves in the bunker, you know, boiling our water and everything.
Are we survivalist? Are we able to do it?
Right. And it's like, why are we even talking about survival? Something this big really happened. It's not clear that we would even make it out. You know?
And I think that's the kind of really darker side of apocalyptic visions is that the reality is that it's very, I don't know, this kind of apocalypse vision, whether it be nuclear war or environmental disaster, is very likely to leave nothing but the earth itself behind.
Right,
and that
right.
and that I think is too big for people to contemplate on an everyday level. So you need the protagonist to guide you through it,
course.
To kind of give you a sense that it's going to happen. And I bring up this makes me think
it can
about,
never be a total apocalypse. In other words, there's
at
always
least in our
be,
imaginations.
Yeah, and maybe that's just a product of the of how literature and how film works is that we always have to we have to be imagining whoever is recording this. You know, like,
yeah.
who's watching this?
Mm-hmm, and, exactly.
And I mean, it's partly that we have to have faith that humanity will survive,
right, in some capacity.
But
I
you
think
rarely
about...
see a work of literature or film that. It takes the apocalypse all the way.
Right. Because
like, it's like the film would just disintegrate at the end.
Well, doesn't Cormac McCarthy's The Road come kind of close to that? It's one of the reasons I've stayed away from it.
Not really. The Road, and I don't want to spoil anything for those of you who haven't seen it, but no, it's not a total apocalypse.
It's not
it's bad. There's
right.
definitely very few people left, but there's people left,
right.
and they're starting to rebuild the society, in a
well,
sense.
Well, what I was going to say is I was thinking about Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, which is
can you say who Octavia Butler is?
Because
I know
yeah.
that you read a lot of her stuff, but I do not, and I know that you know more about her than I do. But who is Octavia Butler? She's a popular writer.
Yeah, Octavia Butler was an African American writer, primarily of science fiction. And she died in 2006. She died pretty recently. She was fairly young. She was born in 1947. And her she wrote several different series of books, some of which dealt with there's a whole series around American slavery that uses the trope of time travel to get the protagonist into the period of slavery to experience
great.
It and bring it forward. This one here, Parable of the Sower, is part of what was going to be a trilogy, but there were only two written, Parable of the Sower and then Parable of the Talents. And Parable of the Sower is really terrifying. It's if we think about, you know, the apocalypse is sort of two visions of it, one while it's happening and then one post-apocalyptic.
Right, right.
And so Parable of the Sower kind of straddles the two. So you're dropped into the story. There has been near what looks like total economic collapse and, more importantly, an incredible environmental collapse.
How far in the future does this story take place?
Not very. 2024. So we're approaching it.
Oh,
it was
it.
Published in 1993, and it takes place in California, and it draws on two very serious and real things that go on in California. One being in 1992, the LA riots, triggered off of the Rodney King trial.
Right. I remember it well.
Yes. And then the other issues around environment, particularly of water and water in the desert, and the lack of access to clean and fresh water, and becomes an incredible
that's a
driving
very common
force.
Trope actually.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
I'm thinking of Mad Max. I'm thinking of Waterworld.
Yes.
And Waterworld was kind of a version of like a big pop version.
A big
of Mad
pop
Max,
version of this.
Sense.
Yeah. And so Parable of the Sower gives you the heroine, Lauren Olamina, who deals with this anxiety of distrust of the people around her, of realizing that the only way to survive, if there's anywhere to survive, is to open up that trust a bit and gather people around her. And it ends up being a very classic form of the journey, the quest.
Right.
And so they start in LA, and it's a gated community that collapses, and there's violence, and there's arson, and there's rape, and there's just everything is
total,
a disaster.
Total social chaos.
Absolutely. Right. Total social chaos. And the journey of the story
you
is
you don't
the,
need zombies in a situation
no,
like that.
No. The humans are that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they travel the 101 up toward San Francisco in search of water, in search of something else.
Sounds like I would really like this story.
I have
story.
Been telling
yeah.
you. You would really
gotta,
like
I
this.
I
got to
read
yeah.
this Octavia Butler.
It's amazing. And it's that thing about the ambiguity of, and you know, the desire, and what you were saying about the our poetic visions of apocalypse almost always include a hero or a heroine,
right,
someone
right.
to lead us through right. it. And that's also part of, I think, a really interesting idea that we need to see what it looks like after we are gone.
Yeah, right, right. And it's like it's kind of like a weird way of providing that 2020 hindsight in a sense. You know, like, here, let's project the future. And that gets me to something I wanted to bring up, which is that it seems like you could maybe, and maybe they all do this in a sense, and maybe this is a false dichotomy, but it seems like some apocalyptic fiction falls more into the category of like heavy social or political critique.
Absolutely.
While as others are more aiming towards entertainment. I'm thinking like Armageddon, yes, or Deep Impact, those 90s movies.
Independence Day.
Right.
Yeah.
And that there are others that are meant more to envision the apocalypse as almost a political act, right? The one that I think both of us, and a lot of people, I think, saw this film and it resonated powerfully with them, is called Children of Men.
Yes, Alfonso Cuarón.
Alfonso Cuarón. That's in 2006, I believe.
Yeah.
Starring Clive Owen. And for those of you who haven't seen Children of Men, I recommend it, but it's not an easy ride. Children of Men envisions an apocalypse that's almost happening right now. Yeah. Instead of like 2024, it just kind of like takes everything that's going on right now, from climate crisis to
political crisis,
terrorism and torture and corporatism and all that kind of stuff, and just kind of blows it up and puts it right in your face in a way that's really, really, really visceral. And it's an incredible movie. And envisions, I don't want to talk about too much about this movie, but at the same time, it's a science fiction movie. It's a movie that is about the human inability to conceive. At some point, women stop getting pregnant.
Right. That we're unable
and
that's a very,
to. That's an incredibly disturbing idea. In fact, so disturbing that I told my parents to watch this movie and they couldn't finish it. They were they couldn't finish it, not because of the like really, I don't know, the violence of the movie, which is
no, it's not.
Violence is pretty. I mean, it's tonally pretty hard to watch. But it was actually the idea
story.
Itself.
Yeah.
Just the idea that it made them so depressed and so sad. And maybe that's like something like an expression of exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Is that Children of Men actually took it too far in the sense of like this idea of let's show you what the society would look like if it went the wrong way.
Well,
Children of Men does that so well that you can't even look at it. It's like too much.
Yeah, that what you said, if it went the wrong way, this is something that authors do, right? Margaret Atwood does this in The Handmaid's Tale, and Octavia Butler does this in Parable of the Sower, and Cuarón does this in Children of Men, that you take what's happening right now and you throw it forward to its logical end. Like,
right,
if we
right.
stay on this path, this is what it's going to look like.
Well,
and it's horrific, right? I had almost the same kind of reaction that your parents did. When I first saw Children of Men, I basically said, no. I came away.
You didn't walk out of the movie.
No, I didn't walk out of the movie.
You finished it.
But I came out of it.
It does have kind of an uplifting kind of thing happening at the end, in a sense.
Well, you know, I don't want to
give it away, but the movie is about. I mean, the basic plot of the movie is that
there's hope.
Is that there's Clive Owen's character has discovered one pregnant woman. In a world where no one has been pregnant for something like 15 years.
Right, and the youngest person has just died, and the youngest person at that point was like 17,
yeah,
yeah, 15
so,
or 17
yeah, so
or something.
It was like, it's about kind of the persistence of humanity in the face of all this. So
right.
there is something beautiful to it, but it's also, the society that it depicts is so close to our own.
That's the thing.
That it's hard to watch.
And that's the thing, is that it is so close to present, it is only mildly sci-fi apocalyptic fantasy. And that's the same thing with Parable of the Sower, is that the kind of the main character has this made up kind of disease called hyperempathy, and it's the kind of sci-fi, I'm making the quote signs and the air quotes,
yes,
the sci-fi. And it is science fiction, but only mildly so, because it is a deliberate critique.
Right.
And Children of Men is that kind of where I came away, and I found all these film flaws about it. Well, you know, the sort of cinematography sound here and all this, because it was so upsetting to me that I couldn't deal with it.
I had a similar reaction. Children of Men is actually one of lots of movies that, for me, and maybe this is something that other people will recognize, and this is why I share it, is that oftentimes when I see movies that are really challenging, I'll just hate them.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
And I'll walk away from it and I'm like, that
was
the dumbest.
Terrible.
And I'll admit right now, I wasn't a fan of Children of Men. I probably came out of that movie thinking it was pretty lame. I felt the same way about There Will Be Blood. I thought the same way about a lot of movies and that I now consider to be absolute masterpieces. So,
yeah. And it is, and with this
I guess
one
that's
in particular,
part of me encouraging people to watch movies more than once, particularly ones that bother you.
Yeah.
Because the ones that bother you are the ones that have the meat in them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They bother you for a reason.
Yeah.
And you ought to, for me, you ought to explore that, you know, and find out why. You know?
Yeah. And I think that Children of Men does that really, really well. So it's mm-hmm. very easy to pick at all these very small things that are, you know, you don't like about the filmmaking, but the plot, this is one of those movies where the plot is not the plot, but the story is yes. all right.
Yeah,
it's not,
right.
it's not a visually challenging movie. It's not a movie like that where it's an experimental avant-garde film.
At the same time, it has an incredible kind of visual style.
Yes. It's gorgeous. Yeah.
It's got lots of really long takes. That's
yes.
what it's known for. Just mm-hmm. amazing Steadicam. And that visual style is part of what makes the movie work. In fact, I just watched it's on YouTube, but it's also on the DVD of the movie. Slavoj Žižek, who's one of my favorite kind of cultural theorists, he does a kind of analysis of Children of Men. He really liked the movie, and one of the things he said makes it work is the fact that there's so many long unbroken shots that you feel like you're kind of with these people walking through this world,
right.
and it's all in the background, and that's what he's like. That's where ideology functions, right?
Right.
It's
right.
like the and you can see it if you're just kind of asked to look at the background, and
right.
that's what this movie. How this movie visually functions. But another thing that he said, and I think this gets to your point, which is that he said that the philosopher Hegel once made the point that a portrait of someone, like a painting or a portrait of someone, is a visual rendering that is somehow captures the soul of the person. It captures more than like a photograph, right? A painting,
right.
a good painting and a real portrait will somehow capture the inner being
mm-hmm.
more, and it will be like almost more of the person than the actual person in a sense. And so what he said is that you used Hegel's point to talk about Children of Men. The Children of Men is a portrait of our times.
Yes.
It's like a painting that in looking at it, it brings out more than what's really, what's there and kind of highlights what the essence of the thing
yeah,
really
that's,
is.
That's
and so I love that point.
A non-apocalyptic version of that is I just read this, William Carlos Williams. He was talking about poems, right? And he
yes.
says that, you know, there's two elements to poems. There's the poem, there's the common sense, the like, what do these words mean, right? And there's just the poem. He's like, but then there's the bigger
yes,
thing about
right.
the poetry, about mm-hmm. the poem. And he says, and
the
that's,
untouchable.
He's like, that's the difficult part. That's
yes.
the part that's the real, that's the fun and the beauty of the poem.
And I would even say it's the magic and the alchemy, right?
It's the hard part, the capturing. And that's why I, you know, we keep coming back to this idea of why are we so fascinated with apocalyptic visions, with sci-fi visions, with horror visions of ourselves, because it gets at the kind of hard part,
yes,
right?
That
right. we can,
and
that we don't
part,
know about
that
ourselves.
That hard part is something that, you know, if you were a Freudian, you would call that the subconscious, right? But
mm-hmm.
but it's more for me about kind of these fictional works somehow locking up and linking up with thoughts and spirit, right? So what's inside you? In other words, however you want to envision that. These fictional works link up with those things, with those kind of elements of your inner being, and create a kind of response, right?
Yeah, and I would bring that. I would even I would go toward Jung, and I would say that it's
mm-hmm.
a collective. The collective
yeah,
unconscious,
right?
Right.
This is why this is happening at a grand scale.
Yes,
right. Yeah.
right. And I know that
that Armageddon, etc.
In philosophy and psychology, Jung is not necessarily I don't know, in favor all the time. But I really believe that there's something.
He's poo-pooed in a way that Freud is not.
But
that's
right,
maybe, that's maybe another show. But it's
right.
but for those of you
something
out there that are listening and are familiar with Freud, because Freud's ideas are so well known, you know, the id, ego,
still,
unconscious,
yeah.
all that kind of stuff. That look at Jung a little bit, because Jung's got some exciting kind of takes on the same kind of stuff, and he's got like he tilts just a little bit to a more, I don't want to call it mystical, but he's got some
people would though.
Yeah, it's a little more fun, a little more imaginative, not so much tied up with how much you hate your mother and your
right.
father.
Exactly.
Right?
So this idea, this collective unconscious, or however you want to describe that, I think. Is okay. So Jung also said, you know, he has the idea about spaceships and about. So if we talk about science fiction,
UFOs, yeah,
UFOs,
he had a whole book
and,
called
right.
Flying Saucers,
and how
yeah.
why do people believe they see UFOs,
right?
And so the question of reality is sort of almost moot. It doesn't really matter. The real interesting issue is that human beings do envision these things. We envision the ghosts. We envision the apocalypse. We envision the UFOs. We see all this stuff as, yes. And we all do it. We all pick up on it. And this is, you know, for the hardcore science people, this is a scientific thing. Mm-hmm. The picking up on what each other do. And this is the sort of, if you want to say, mass hysteria or mass experiences, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That these are real things. And that's why this stuff is so interesting. So how is it that we in the 21st century envision our end?
Yeah.
Do we,
yeah.
You know what we've stopped doing to some extent is we don't envision off world in the same way anymore. We're not envisioning traveling to other planets to start new civilizations.
Well,
I mean, we do
bit.
It, but
yeah.
not, I don't think that we're doing it to the same extent that we are envisioning,
you know,
the
what
collapse
we're doing?
On Earth.
Yeah. You know what we're doing is that fantasy, that off Earth fantasy is such I don't know. I feel like it's an expression of failure.
Yeah,
in a sense.
Right.
It's just like,
right.
Oh well, you know,
we're obviously not going to do
like
that.
Like so many stories are like that take place on an off Earth thing, or kind of just take for granted that, well, we destroyed the Earth. Human beings destroyed the Earth at a
right.
certain point, or water ran out, or there was nuclear apocalypse.
Right.
And now we found second Earth, and we
right.
all live on second Earth
right.
now.
We were just talking about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, yeah. I forget what it was, but
Earth 2 or
Earth
something.
Earth 2, and there's that idea, and I'm thinking of Avatar, actually,
yeah.
Which was a big off-world
yeah, you're right,
work.
You're right, that was.
But not so much a work of apocalypse, but a little bit, because it was about kind of envisioning resources running out on Earth and that we had to find other civilizations.
Well, also, abroad...
So it was really just a Pocahontas colonization story,
yeah.
You know, told on that scale.
But in one sense of the word apocalypse, is the end of one and the beginning. It's the unveiling, and so it's something mm-hmm. new, and it ends the one thing. And so anytime you have that off world falls kind of into this, because it means that something has
yeah.
shifted and we've moved to something else. And
it's weird because it's just such a weird. You get, you know, so many weird kind of admissions of failure of the large, you know, large institutional structures of the Earth. You know, like, oh, it was capitalism that brought everything down. It was all our greed and everything. But you get these visions from Hollywood itself. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and I brought up James Cameron just now because, mm-hmm. you know, the guy works in sci-fi a lot and has particularly a apocalyptic vision in a lot of his movies. But Terminator 1
yes.
and Terminator, and I know
we just watched Terminator 2.
and, you know, those are awesome movies in a sense of like how, they're great Hollywood action movies,
yes.
right? And they're
mm-hmm.
like kind of, and when I say awesome, I mean they're kind of iconic visions
yes.
of what the apocalypse might be, particularly Terminator 2 with the, and I think everyone in your mind can conjure this image, right, of Linda Hamilton holding on to the chain link fence
yes,
as the children get burned up
yeah,
and she
nuclear apocalypse,
and Los Angeles is hit by a
yep.
nuclear bomb, and she, you know, she literally disintegrates into bones on
yeah.
screen. It's an incredibly memorable moment.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also just this weird kind of admission that like, oh yeah, of course all this will fall one day. And you know, and
yeah,
of course
yeah.
we're all, it's almost taken for granted
that this
like,
will happen
human
in some
beings
form.
Are shits that are going to destroy the whole Earth. And it's a weird kind of thing to get from the system that is kind of creating the culture, is this admission that the culture is toxic. Is that toxic?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting idea. Where is it coming from? Because if you think about... Because if you look at literary history, right, you're seeing writers respond to the things that are happening, right? In the 50s and 60s, there's a glut of... both of literature that is about new worlds,
mm-hmm,
that is about
mm-hmm.
traveling to the moon, that is about societies and other places, that's about alien invasion. And that a lot of that has to do with nuclear, like actual nuclear usage and threat of war that's happening in the 50s and 60s. And then, it, you know, sort of Hollywood is producing that as well and picking up on that. And there's this kind of back and forth of who's creating who,
yeah,
right? Where does this actually come from? And I feel like it's sort of a back and forth of...
The end of the world is ubiquitous during the 1950s. I think during that post-war period, after the United States dropped two atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945... You have I think that you can't overestimate the kind of
yeah.
psychological shock that produced
yeah.
not only in Japanese society
around
and,
the world
and European society, but in the whole world.
Everything
and
tilts.
It actually, yeah, and it actually the fact that American films started envisioning their own apocalypse mm-hmm. when Americans were actually the only ones that had the nuclear bomb is kind of a weird guilt expression yeah. in a kind of like, yeah. oh, we're eventually going to destroy the whole world. And, you know, I think of, I show the movie Rebel Without a Cause quite yeah. a bit, not the whole movie, but clips from it. And one of the clips I show is when James Dean and Sal Mineo and Natalie Wood and all those characters end up going to the Griffith Observatory. Yeah, they're very, very right. famous scene in that movie. And it's they watch
another LA movie.
Yeah, yeah. And they watch a kind of like presentation about the stars, and it mm-hmm. kind of has an ear of nuclear apocalypse and that we could blow up at any time. And it's yeah. kind of talking about, it's using the solar system
yeah.
and the kind of I don't know, the unpredictable nature of the solar system to talk about how we could blow up at any time.
Yeah.
And it's clear what the movie is kind of engaging there. You know, this kind of larger conversation about the end of the world becomes a much more real kind of discussion in the 1950s.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
And, you know, I think of Allen Ginsberg and yep. and Bob Dylan. Ginsberg tells a story about hanging out with Bob Dylan in the East Village during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. They felt like they're sitting there drinking beers or coffee or something like that, talking and feeling like a nuclear bomb could go off in New York at any moment.
Yeah.
And they had this kind of eerie sense that it was this weird kind of almost humorous, like they felt free and they felt comic about it. And maybe that's the nature of these guys, you know, that they had a particularly cynical thing.
I think it's that ambiguity of, and it's why we are both repelled and fascinated by the visions of the apocalypse, because mm-hmm. it's this, there is an almost sort of freedom in that release of whatever systems you are part of, including the system of your own body, which is exhausting
yeah,
sometimes,
yeah, yeah.
right? And
it's the death fantasy coupled
yes,
with the death fear.
Yes.
It's like death in all, the vision of the apocalypse is the vision of death in all its kind of dynamism.
Yes.
And that death is both
complicated.
Something,
yeah,
death yeah. We have so much cultural anxiety about death, obviously,
yeah.
and I'm not the first to point that out. There's a Pulitzer Prize winning work that I'm called Denial of Death, but I'm forgetting the author's name now. But either way, that idea that we have a really, really complicated engagement with the idea of death in our culture, and not a particularly healthy one, and it comes out in these weird ways, right? It comes
Ernest
out
Ernest Becker, 1973.
Ernest Becker.
Mm-hmm.
Denial of Death, a book that will blow your mind. I know a lot of you have read it, but either way, this idea that death is not just something that's that we're afraid of. It's something
no.
that we fantasize about
right.
too. It's something that we spend actually quite a bit of thought is kind of goes to imagining that.
Yeah, exactly. Like what will that look like? And I mean, these are you know, worldwide philosophical foundations
mm-hmm.
based
yeah.
upon the human or the I don't know, the alive
yes.
becoming that, right?
Right,
there are
right.
systems of thought,
yeah,
obviously. And I think that we're talking about just one aspect of the kind of cultural production of what this looks like.
You're talking about religion.
I'm talking about religion. I'm talking about philosophy. I'm
yeah.
talking about spiritualism. Right. There's, you know.
So it's like you can see maybe something like The Stand or I Am Legend or these, you know, kind of or The Walking Dead as religious stories in a sense,
yeah.
because
well,
they're about like a life, death, afterlife kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look, I mean, Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower is literally, I mean, the Parable of the Sower is part of the New Testament, the Parable of the Sower. It's
okay.
the where you, the sort of in very short sum, the story is where you sow your seeds and you sow the seeds in rocky land and nothing grows, and you sow your seed in desert and it doesn't grow. But when you find quote unquote good earth, things will grow
yeah,
and things
right.
will flourish.
Yeah.
And it's a parable because it talks about, you know, human nature and human civilizations and societies of what is good,
yeah.
right? What is, right. how do we be alive and how do we be fruitful? And I don't mean that necessarily in the Christian sense, but in the human sense,
yeah.
right? In the,
mm-hmm.
maybe the philosophical sense. And so she takes that and she literally is pulling that from the New Testament in terms of parable, right? Like standing
yeah.
in this kind
right.
of story that you tell about because we don't know what we are, I guess.
Right,
so we
right.
have varying ideas on what we are and what we're supposed to do and what we're supposed to be. Are we going for...
We're highly intelligent apes.
And we don't understand a lot. And we don't understand much of it. And then we have all kinds of systems to help us figure that out. And there's this always... There's this nagging big part of it that's the end of it.
Right?
And that's the kind of, you know, how does science fiction and how does... I mean, I would even bring in horror films and horror movies and horror books, literature into this conversation of how do we, you know,
they all play their role, you know, the vampire, the werewolf,
yes, and they've all had the
zombie, they all they and I'm not saying
the ghosts
that, and I'm not saying these things all have like fixed cultural meanings that you can look up like a dream dictionary I dreamed about this, so therefore that the zombie equals my own fear of death. You know, these are just ideas that I think are important to talk about, particularly in a during a time when, you know, we have both the like I said, the kind of actual apocalyptic thinkers and that kind of being a trope in our politics, but also quite a bit of this kind of material being produced by Hollywood and by, you know, other entities that create the culture, right?
Right. You know, and I think about, you know, because I would not describe myself as an apocalyptic thinker necessarily, in real terms of like economic collapse, because I think part of me is in denial of that, right?
I don't think it necessarily has to be denial. It's kind of like...
I'm trying to vision it in a different way,
Yeah, and you know, Justin and I talked about climate change in the last episode.
Right.
And we hit on this a little bit with Alex Jones and that kind of thing. And what Justin and I settled on, I think Justin made a really great point, which is that when you become an apocalyptic thinker, when you become like the person that says like, okay, we're in the end times and we're going to watch the collapse of society happen in our lifetime, you take out a lot of agency, right? You basically say like it's a teleology. You're basically like, well, the story is already settled, so I have nothing to do.
Yeah.
Like the only thing I can do, I can like move out to the woods and gather guns and, you know, live out that zombie fantasy in a sense.
Right.
And so it's like by becoming a doomsday prepper, you basically, you know, settle yourself on one direction that the future could go. And you know, not saying that there aren't signs that the future could go that way, but it is important to recognize, and I hear your voice a lot in my head when I think this way, because I know you're kind of you're not an apocalyptic thinker in the sense that you're more of a, I wouldn't call you a naive optimist at all. I would think that you kind of just don't want to think that way. And I think that's understandable, right?
Well, I think that I'm...
By saying like, oh, well, it's like saying, well, we're all going to die, so what's the point?
Right. I'm not a nihilist in that sense.
There's a defeatism.
Right, which I'm not yet willing to embrace. Maybe I went through it too much as a teenager.
Yeah,
you know, that sort of, what's the point? But for me, and it's interesting that because I think about you a lot about as an apocalyptic thinker and how I'm not that, but... I am
for those of that know me. I do spend a lot of time thinking about the end of the world,
exactly.
and associated with you know, the Mayan end date of 2012. I was really into that for a long time.
Yeah.
I thought maybe that there's something to that. I still think maybe there's something to it. Maybe we pass through the, you know, the chrysanthemum at the end of history, and we're not even real anymore. I don't know.
But okay, so for me, it's because
that's for another show. We'll talk about the chrysanthemum on another show.
So for me, I think that I'm not so different from you. I just approach it in a different way, right? So you tend not to like movies that are too much about, they're too much have fantasy element to them, right?
Yeah, I don't like wizards. Ghosts are fine. I don't like wizards and dragons and people that say, my lord, my lord. I don't like those.
Whereas I'm far more willing to embrace that. And I think it's part of a larger way of the way that I deal with impending changes and collapses and
things that scare
altering.
You about a larger society.
And so I'm far more interested in envisioning it through ghosts, through spirits, through my lord, you know, and the dragon, or whatever it might be, that like for me Children of Men and McCormick McCarthy's The Road is just too much. It's too real. It's amazing to me that I got through Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, honestly.
Or Children of Men.
Or Children of Men. Whereas I far more would rather read, I don't know, or The Shining, you know, horror movies.
Right.
Or
something that abstracts it a little bit
Pan's
for you.
Pan's Labyrinth.
You know, something that something that makes it supernatural.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, right. I need that kind of extracting in order for me to be able to process what it is that we are in that stark terms. It's harder for me to face it in that way, right?
And you mentioned Cormac McCarthy's The Road. I know you haven't read that. And part, you probably haven't read that because of the story that I told about reading that book, which is that, you know, I picked that book up before I went on a trip to Europe by myself a few years ago. And, you know, it had the Oprah's Book Club sticker on the front. So I thought, how bad can this be? And by that I meant
can't
like
be
how
that dark.
But I, you know, I obviously knew that Cormac McCarthy was a heavy hitter. You know, he's a serious author, and so I ended up reading it in Europe, and in a hotel room in Paris by myself over the course of maybe a day. It was one of those books that you can read very, very quickly, and I remember at a certain point, literally like throwing the book across the room. I was so upset, and by upset I mean like.
Existentially,
like I don't know what to do with this.
Yes,
it's a really, really striking rendering of it, of the apocalypse and that kind of end of the world. But it's exactly what you're talking about, in the sense that there's no dragons, you know, there's no like zombie. It's really just
it's not even a ghost.
Nothing supernatural. In fact, you never even understand what happened in the movie.
Yeah,
but that's what makes it so real. Is the sense that it would just be a kind of chaotic life of homelessness and death and fear and paranoia. It's really, really stark. I mean, it makes The Stand look really fun.
Right, which
like
it
Stand,
is, yeah.
The Stand is actually fun. Like,
yeah, that
I
was
mean,
my
if you
first
recall,
real...
There's even like King, you know, Stephen King does all sorts of stuff in the Stand because it's a huge work. It's like 1,200 pages or something like that. But it's got all his typical stuff, including the sexual fantasies, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, there's even like, there's the fat kid in, I think his name is Harold, the character, right?
who finally gets
laid because he's the last dude around. And like Stephen King, of course, spends like quite a bit of time on that fantasy. And as a kid, as a teenager, I wasn't a fat teenager, but I was a virgin teenager reading this in high school. I thought, wow, end of the world, you know, I'd be the last guy, you know,
exciting.
And there'd be girls around.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so, you know, I bring that up to say that The Road does not have that element at all. The Road brings it to a very, very stark kind of reality. And the fact that Oprah picked that book is still kind of stunning to me, because it speaks to some really, really dark truths about the American way of life and where it's headed.
Right. And so so the veneer of science fiction in Parable of the Sower is very thin. It is. And it's why I picked it up, not realizing how very real and present it was going to be when I first picked it up a few years ago.
Right.
And I literally did. I read a few chapters and then I put it down. And it took me several weeks before I picked it back up, because it's so well done, and it's. But it was almost that too much, and it's interesting how we you know, the movies like The Day After Tomorrow, right, which are full of the kind of, you know,
those are like a series of
special effects
movies,
right,
where you
that
kind
are
of
just
see the Statue of Liberty you know
with, right
being
and
taken down. I mean,
those to me are not scary at all. Those are the sort of the fun vision, even though they're supposed to be serious, I guess.
Right.
But you know, I kind of
it's
need
a weird kind of fun. I mean,
it is a weird kind of fun.
I mean, particularly when you think of the fact that and you know, I definitely want to do a show about this kind of stuff in the future. But the idea of New York, you know, as the kind of center and the
or LA.
And you know, these movies have come out, many of them, especially, you know, like Transformers or The Avengers did it too, destroyed New York after 9/11, right?
Yeah.
And it's like I remember this because I was a big news junkie. I think a lot of us were in the months and even a few years after 9/11. You had this, especially right when it happened, people were on TV, pundits were on TV saying like, we'll never watch another action movie in which buildings blow up. We'll never do this. You know, we'll never enjoy this again because it just got real.
I remember those conversations too.
And so, you know, whatever we were fantasizing about in all these movies like Die Hard and all, you know, these exploding buildings, we'll never, ever go that way again because it's so disrespectful. But then, you know,
but of course we
did. I just mentioned the Avengers and
Transformers.
Cloverfield does the Statue of Liberty. And of course, the Statue of Liberty is always the apocalyptic icon, it seems like.
Planet of the Apes. That's what I was thinking about before.
Right. And I mean, obviously, Cloverfield is kind of referencing that. But either way, there's this thing that, like, the destruction of New York City is the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so when 9/11 happens, you get this kind of weird intrusion of fictional fantasy into reality, and that kind of interaction is fascinating to me because you have this moment where people are like, oh, you know, how ashamed we are that we almost brought this on ourselves by envisioning this fantasy of New York being destroyed,
and yet it
continues in culture. Like, we continue to have this vision.
And so we're compelled.
Even with Hurricane Sandy last year, you know, there were these images on the internet that went around that were images ripped from movies that were Photoshopped. They're like, this is what's happening in New York right now. Yep. And they were kind of like these viral memes and jokes on the internet that kind of recognize this, right?
Yeah.
This, like, we have this collective fantasy of New York being destroyed because we feel like New York is the representative of America, and particularly America's political and economic system.
Mm-hmm.
And so to envision New York being destroyed over and over again is to literally envision that system dying.
Yeah, it seems like we're compelled to envision that over and over again, with that you have to have an outlet for experiencing that the end in before it happens or as it's happening. Or how, I mean, if you think about the process of creating art, right? Mm-hmm, whether it be film or fiction or poetry or paintings or whatever it is that's how that kind of narrative element is how we figure it out. It's how we experience it, and that you have to, there has to be all kind, and that's why it's you know, some of these films and artworks, they offend people, and they're like, well, this is too, you know, like, I mean, I said, not that Children of Men offended me, but my initial instinct was, well, this is too much. I don't want to see movies
like this. Yeah.
I mean, we know people who say, I want to watch movies to be entertained,
right,
and I need to feel good, and I totally understand that.
I don't need to have shit rubbed in my face.
Because it's already in my face.
And I certainly don't need to be told look at that the society newspaper I'm a part of is falling apart.
Right.
It's very depressing.
But at the same time, we really do seem to need it. Yes, in whatever form we get it, that we have
whether
to.
whether it be, you know, Will Smith and the dogs fighting the vampires or Children of Men, either way, like, everyone seems to have some need to fantasize in this way. And I'm not saying that everybody is a fan of apocalyptic fiction.
No.
But in some way,
in cultural terms,
in cultural terms, there's a reason why this stuff is popular. In the same way that we envision and we fantasize about our own deaths as an escape from our body, we fantasize about the apocalypse as an escape from our system and the way we live while we're still alive. I feel like this went very fast. Did we miss some major?
Oh, I'm sure we missed many major, major
works,
cultural moments.
But
so
they come up a lot. And, I think we got to what I wanted to get to, which was to kind of think about why we like apocalyptic fiction so much and what it means to have a culture where this fantasy is projected everywhere all the time.
Yeah.
I'm glad we had this conversation, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again. So thank you very much, Claudia.
Thank you very much.